Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Diana Ross wants muscles, and tonight we are going to talk muscles and bodybuilding because the sport of bodybuilding has been around for millennia. In fact, the idea of the perfect physical specimen, and early on in history we were mostly talking about the male physique, was well and truly around in antiquity. The Greeks and the Romans certainly had their own ideals about body muscularity and symmetry. Now, women are very active in bodybuilding and they compete on stage in competitions along with the men. Well, tonight we thought we'd take a look at bodybuilding through the experience of two people who've been competitive bodybuilders. Nigel Bartlett is an author and a journalist. A few years ago, somewhere around 40-something, he decided to take up competitive bodybuilding seriously, and we'll hear about his journey to the competition stage tonight. Nigel, hello. Thanks for coming in.
Good evening.
Mariah Stock is a fitness blogger and enthusiast and a one-time competitive bodybuilder as well. Hi, Mariah.
Hi.
And we've also got Dr. Maya Underwood with us, an anthropologist from the University of Queensland. And Maya's particularly interested in where bodybuilding fits into our contemporary culture. Hello, Maya. Welcome to Nightlife to you too.
Hi, Suzanne. Thanks for having me.
Well, Maya, let's start with you and define bodybuilding first. Do you consider it as a sport or an art form or a bit of both?
I think the latter, that it's a bit of both. I mean, it's a sport. It's about testing the limits of the body, how much muscle, not necessarily always how much, but the muscle that is developed and the reduction of fat. So it's not just about muscle. It's very important to emphasize that it's equally about the reduction of fat so that you can see the muscle. It's sort of making the interior visible. So it's a sport. It's about the limits of the body. It takes extreme discipline and control, but it's also about the aesthetics of the body, how balanced the body is, how tapered it is. Bodybuilders who, you know, are right into this sport can see aspects of the body that us as uneducated laymen can't even notice. They're tailoring small muscles that we wouldn't even notice a difference in, just to make that perfect sculpture.
Yeah. Nigel, what are your thoughts? Sport, art, a bit of both?
I agree. I think it's a bit of both. But when I started to take it up competitively, I chose to see it as a sport because I'd been training in the gym for quite a long time, which was really about vanity for me and wanting to look good. And then when I decided to compete, I decided for myself that I wanted to see it as a sport, that it was about stepping up on stage and trying. I know that there's certain criteria you need to meet. And I decided to see it in that way, that I'd never been involved in any sport before, but this is my opportunity to take part in a sport for the first time in my life.
And Mariah, what do you think?
Yeah, I'd agree that it's a bit of both. So a sport in the sense that I took it very seriously, as in I was incredibly rigid with my regiment, with my process and everything, but and also an art form in the sense that it allows you to actually sculpt your own body and create a shape, very much like an artist in that sense. So you can actually alter your proportions depending on your genetics and a few other factors, of course.
And did you both have, as Maya just described it, were you tinkering with muscles and little bits of the body that the rest of us don't know exist, Nigel?
I don't think I was quite so conscious of that. But definitely what Maya was saying about getting as lean as possible, because I'm not a big guy. I'm certainly not, you know, walking around. People wouldn't look at me and go, oh, he's a bodybuilder. But to get on stage, I had to lose a lot of body fat and really makes everything pop. All the muscles pop out and all the veins, the vascularity shows. So, in that sense, I was noticing muscles that I never knew I had, and I became a bit like an anatomical drawing, really, when people looked at me later.
Mariah, did you learn about bits of your body you didn't know about as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was training for several years before I started competing. I actually ended up doing 8 competitions. And in that time frame, yeah, I discovered new muscles like the serratus, which is kind of here on the side that not many people know about, all kinds of little details that pop out as you become leaner, yeah.
Yeah. So, Maya, humans have always wanted to change their bodies, haven't they? I mean, tattooing, scarification. Is bodybuilding just a mega form of body modification, or is it something else?
I think you can see it as an extension of the, you know, this human tendency to change our bodies. It's sort of the original canvas for us to, you know, to alter, to decorate, to express ourselves. So I don't see it as inherently different. It's just a different way of decorating and expressing the self than what we did throughout history.
Yeah, and so Maya, if we break it down very simply, what is bodybuilding? I think, is it the use of training to make muscles large and defined? Is that how you define it very simply?
I think you could define it that simply, but I think it's probably necessary to include in that it's the control of diet also to make the body appear muscular and lean. Because for a lot of bodybuilders tell me the training is the easy part, and it's not easy. It hurts and it takes a lot of time and effort. But the diet is the bit that is really hard to stick to because it has to be so incredibly strict to, you know, retain the muscle as well as lose the fat.
Yeah. Nigel, what was your experience of the diet aspect of being a bodybuilder?
Yeah, that was definitely the most challenging part for me, especially as I'm older. I'm now 56, and when I competed on stage, I think I was 54, actually. My coach got me dieting for quite a long time, from about October through to May. I'd already been dieting a little bit before that, and the calories went down and the calories went down and the calories went down, and I had to be very strict about recording everything I ate, and if my partner was cooking anything, and I'd be watching him like a hawk, you know, how much oil are you putting in that? If we went out for breakfast, I would allow myself to have a slice of toast, some salmon on the side, some two poached eggs, and that was my cafe breakfast if ever we went out, you know, whereas normally I'd be having scrambled eggs, bacon, butter on the toast, all this sort of thing. I was very, very controlled. At stages I'd be choosing between do I have a second coffee, a second flat white, or can I have an apple instead some point during the day? It was getting so ridiculous. I was making, you know, choosing between 100 calories in a coffee or 100 calories in an apple, you know. So it was a strange period. Yeah.
Isn't it interesting? I've always thought about the weightlifting part, but I've never really thought about the dieting part. But that's extreme dieting by the sounds of it.
Towards the end, yes, it felt very extreme. Not all through it, but there was a point where, I was monitoring absolutely everything. I was putting things on a spreadsheet and entering foods into my app on my phone and that sort of thing, and reporting back to my coach, and if my weight wasn't going down, it would be okay, well, we need to reduce the calories a bit further, and I'd be like, oh no, not any further.
Mariah, was it a similar story for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very all or nothing. I'm very high effort. If I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it properly, so I weighed everything until the gram. But I have to say that before I started competing, I was already tracking my food, and I initially started tracking food and recording it and counting the macronutrients, so the fat, carbs and protein of everything, because when I started, I weighed 45 kilos and I was actually doing it to eat enough to gain weight. So then when I started competing, it switched to a reduction to lose weight.
I'm wondering with this kind of, I mean, it sounds like hell to me, but, you had your own dreams. But I'm wondering if that makes it unsustainable to be a bodybuilder for years and years and years. Nigel?
If you're competing, you would be in off-season and on-season.
Oh, okay.
Contest prep and off-season, I think that is how we'd probably call it. So when you go into contest prep, that's when you're basically losing the, for me anyway, that's when I was losing body fat. and it was a long, slow process for me. During the off season, generally, and you know, I can't talk for everyone, but generally, you'd be eating more and you'd be wanting to build muscle, and you might actually be, you'd probably be eating more calories than you need. So you can, for some people, they'd be eating a lot more calories than they need to. And for some people, it's actually quite a struggle to eat more than as much as they want to, as much as they need to. I don't think it's unsustainable over a long period of time. It's certainly, I would say that it would be unsustainable to stay at that level of leanness that you need to be on stage. You can't stay like that and be healthy for a long period of time. At least I couldn't anyway.
So this is also new to me, bodybuilding seasons. Mariah, just describe the seasons of bodybuilding to us then.
Yeah, it depends on the category you're in. So Nigel did bodybuilding. As a woman, you have different categories: bodybuilding, physique, bikini, and bikini being like the least extreme, the closest to kind of a fit dancer or just a particularly fit girl in general. And so that body fat level is a lot more sustainable than, say, that of a physique or a bodybuilding competitor where they have to be much leaner. So for me personally, I used to fluctuate quite greatly between this off-season, on-season, where you put on more weight and then lose it for the shows. And then towards the end, I actually really only deviated maybe 3 or 4 kilos from my stage weight in general. And so it's very easy for me to get to my stage weight and sustain that all year round.
At what time of year is bodybuilding season?
In Australia, we have two seasons, season A, season B. So season A would be first part of the year, probably March to May, June. And then there's a bit of a break over the winter period. And then season B starts again in, I think, maybe late August, probably September, actually, September to late October.
Wow, okay.
In the Northern Hemisphere, it tends to all be through the summer. They tend to have one season through the summer.
If you're really professional, do you, you know, fly from Australia in non-COVID times to Europe and just bodybuilding going in competitions all year round?
I'm obviously not at that stage, but I'm guessing that people who are at that level would do that. I don't know many people who do, but I'm sure there are people who do that, yeah.
Did you, Mariah?
So that tends to be, say, if you become a pro or if you do a qualifier, then you might go overseas to compete in other ones. Or there's usually options where you can go and compete overseas. I didn't go overseas, but yeah, that's what they usually do.
You're on Nightlife with Suzanne Hill. We are exploring the world of bodybuilding on tonight's show. I've got Nigel Bartlett and Mariah Stock in the studio with me. Nigel's an author and journalist and amateur bodybuilder, and Mariah is an Instagram fitness person and a bodybuilder. And we've also got Dr. Maya Underwood with us too, an anthropologist from the University of Queensland. Nigel, is there a certain amount of damage that you have to do to a muscle fibre to make it grow?
Oh, now you're asking me questions that I'm probably not fully qualified to answer. But my understanding of it is that every time you're lifting a weight that's putting stress on the muscle, you are breaking something down in the muscle, and that it's the process of repair in the recovery in between your training sessions that would be building up the muscle. So that's my sort of very basic understanding. And if there was a doctor on the radio.
Mariah's nodding quite a bit there.
Yeah, that's right. They're like micro tears, and then essentially your body will build back the muscle and build it stronger to try and avoid that from happening again. And then we do it again and make it bigger.
Just a bit, Mariah.
Yeah, I think if you're training to your full potential and you're training really hard, then it does hurt. As in, it's tough on the body and recovery too. Particularly if you switch exercises, you tend to get very sore. If you're progressing, you tend to get sore. Yeah.
Yeah, I would challenge that slightly, and I don't mean to be. I think it's very different for everyone, and I think what Mariah is saying can be correct. But also, so for me, I do the same. I've been doing the same program for quite a number of years now. And so I'm not really challenging. I'm not doing new things. But if I were to suddenly switch up and do a different exercise, it's a bit like suddenly you're doing some different sport. and you're using muscles you've never known, then it hurts for me. Or if I've taken a break for a few weeks, that's probably when it hurts. But on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis, it doesn't. But I do think actually everyone's different. Maybe you'd agree with that, perhaps.
So you don't progressively overload?
Oh, yeah, do that. Yeah, absolutely. But the...
So what's progressively overload mean?
We're nodding at each other. So progressive overload would be you would be either trying to increase the weights you're lifting each week. So say if you're doing a bench press, you would be wanting to do higher weights, maybe not every week, but over a period of time, or you'd be wanting to do more repetitions. So instead of doing 10 one week, you'd be doing 12 another week, 14. So it's progressively getting heavier or more, a bit more. Yeah.
Now, I want to ask you, apparently Arnold Schwarzenegger says in the Pumping Iron doco that working out gives him a high. He says it's like an orgasm. Is bodybuilding and working out for you guys feel that way? That delightful?
I have to say, I don't actually love working out. I think that surprises a lot of people. So my favorite part is when I get to eat the food and afterwards when I get to watch movies and so on and so forth. But I have to say, I do train. One of the main reasons I do train so much is I do feel like it helps me mood-wise. So I feel a lot better. I feel much more positive. Yeah, it really impacts my mood in a positive way.
I think that's a no to the actual question,
Nigel. I would say, well, I think the way he's expressed it is not how I would express it. It doesn't make me feel like I'm having an orgasm. But I would say that there are days when I'm in the gym. I hate missing the gym. I have a routine. I like to go to the gym. And if I miss it, I really hate it. I go before work in the mornings. And also, there are times when I'm in the gym where... I'm lifting a weight that I feel is too heavy for me and I'm achieving it. And it's just a very exciting feeling. And it's just between me and no one else knows I'm feeling it. No one else in the gym knows I'm feeling it. I'm not running around saying, woohoo, that's great. But I feel excited and, you know, a real sense of achievement on a daily basis. So that's, you know.
But I guess many sports people would feel the same way. I mean, if I ever actually manage a run without feeling exhausted, I'm also internally giving a bit of a woo-hoo too.
Yeah.
I might go back to Dr. Maya Underwood, an anthropologist at the University of Queensland. Maya, if we go back to the emergence of modern bodybuilding in this country, we have to go back to the 40s and the influence of early bodybuilders like Steve Reeves. Tell us a bit about him and the early days in Australia.
Well, look, I'm not a historian, so I'm probably not the best person to be talking about the early history of bodybuilding. I'm probably more sort of 80s and 90s onwards, unfortunately. So I can't, unfortunately, answer that question for you.
Perhaps you could talk to us about the Arnie era then.
Okay, yeah, sure. Look, Arnie, if you ask anyone about bodybuilding, Arnie's probably the first person that they will think of because he really brought bodybuilding into the mainstream. You know, he did more than just build his body. He used his body as a platform to go on to much bigger things. And, you know, to have quite influence through his movies and also through his politics. So Arnie was what they call the classic era. He had a body that was sort of, you know, Y-shaped and proportionate and people would say aesthetically pleasing. But then after Arnie, the emphasis became more on sheer size, and in the 1990s we saw the emergence of the mass monster, the bodies that look more like a giant X, and they could sometimes not have the tapered waist and the small midsection. It could sometimes become quite blocky, and that came about, most people would say, because of the advent of new bodybuilding drugs like human growth hormone and insulin. So it's no longer just the steroids and sort of fat burners of the earlier years, but these other drugs that just took it to a whole nother level.
Do you think there's a cultural attraction for looking at these hugely muscular bodies?
Oh, definitely. I mean, there is the freak value, obviously. Everyone loves to see someone who looks incredibly different from themselves. But I think it's also about, you know, wow, can a body really look like that? What are the limits of what we can achieve with these bodies? How much muscle can a body hold at this, you know, sub 10%, often sub 5% body fat? It's a really, it's a skillful art. I think people don't appreciate the skill involved in bodybuilding. They think, you know, stereotype meathead, pick heavy thing up, put it down again. But it is much more skillful than that. So it's the sport, and watching someone, you know, an athlete excel in their field is you know, it's pleasing to watch someone do their best. You know, as we said, it's also this art. We've got statues, as you said in the introduction, that are, you know, thousands of years old, that display the muscular body as beautiful. So we have a long history of idealizing this. So it's like looking at a living statue.
Maya, I'm just really interested in like how you came to study this and be more or less an expert in the way that we look culturally at bodybuilding. How did you come to be interested in this?
Well, look, it was really an accident, Suzanne. I wanted to study tattoo. I was really interested in tattoo. I've always been interested in the things that people do with their bodies and the meanings that people attach to their bodies. I really wanted to study tattoo. Well, that's what I thought I wanted to do. And I was applying for grants, but, you know, it doesn't really have national benefit to understand why people put these pictures on their bodies, no matter how fascinating it is. But I thought, oh, well, what else is interesting that people do with their bodies? Oh, muscle is really interesting. And that has the steroid angle, which is health and crime. It's a lot more fundable. I'll go do that just for a little while and, you know, move on to the next thing. And I got into bodybuilding, researching bodybuilding, and it is so fascinating that I've been in doing bodybuilding research for, I think, 5 or 6 years now, and I don't know when I'm going to stop, because there's just so many aspects of it that, as an anthropologist, I find absolutely fascinating.
Going down the rabbit hole, I think you might call it, of bodybuilding, Maya, and finding that there was just so much to study and to learn. So what's next in your study then when it comes to bodybuilding?
Oh, look, it's sort of controlling myself and not going off on too many tangents, but I've spent the last sort of 5 or 6 years working mainly with recreational bodybuilders. So those that don't compete, that are just building muscle for the sort of social benefits and personal benefits. So I think because as an anthropologist, I think it's really interesting to build muscle without the sort of necessity of it for the sport. It's just for what the muscle means. I thought that was really interesting. So I'd like to move beyond recreational bodybuilding into competitive bodybuilding more. And also, I've focused on men so far. So I'd really like to work with women who lift, because it is a whole different kettle of fish for women.
So Mariah and Nigel, I'll bring you back in. If the massive, sometimes freakishly large bodies of the Arnie era aren't necessarily what you're aspiring towards, what do both of you see as the ideal look for men and women? Nigel?
Gosh, well, you know, the ideal look for men and women is very different to who you're talking to. I mean, what I might think is the ideal look certainly isn't what a lot of people would think, and I certainly recognise that bodybuilding and the look of the bodybuilder is often not something that generally in society is people find appealing. You're actually wrong when you said that I wouldn't aspire to that look of the Arnold Schwarzenegger.
If I'd decided
in my 20s or even earlier that I wanted to take this up seriously, I probably would be definitely wanting to go for that. But I came to it very late in my life. And so I now live with, you know, the fact that I'm in my 50s and I don't want to take any chemical enhancement. You know, for me, it is about looking. I do want to look a certain way. I want to look muscular. I want to look fairly lean. when I'm competing, I want to look as good as possible to be on that stage. I don't want to look like the person who's walked onto stage and doesn't really know why he's there, or, you know, I know that there's certain criteria I want to fulfill, and I want people to be able to judge me.
Are there those people at bodybuilding competitions who look on as if they don't know why they're there?
Oh yeah.
Well, once or twice I've seen people like that, and I look, you know, it's not a judgment thing, because I think good on you. You've stepped up and you've decided to do it. But some people have probably done it maybe a little bit too early. You know, you wouldn't go onto a rugby league pitch, you know, as a not really knowing what you're doing. It's just too dangerous. You know, you can get onto a bodybuilding stage and not come to any harm. But on the other hand, there's a certain boundary that you sort of need to be in to be able to say.
So you really should meet certain standards before you kind of step out into the
open. I believe so, yeah. You need to get things, you know, I'm a bit of a perfectionist. You need to sort of be able to get things right. You need to know how to pose. The posing in itself is an art form in itself, and it's quite very strenuous. It's very hard. It's not easy just to get up there and do that posing. You practice that for weeks and weeks, if not months and months.
Really?
And yeah. It's not just a question.
See, I would have thought you just do a bit of, you know, flexing the old non-muscles on my arms, but no, it's way more complex.
My coach is in the US, and I used to have 5 a.m. Skype sessions with him in my kitchen. He would be teaching me how to pose, and I would go off to Bankstown every Saturday afternoon to a posing clinic. Posing clinics are quite
common.
Kidding? Yeah.
Wow.
There'd be about 30 of us in a room in a gym, men and women. You know, I was one of the older ones, definitely. Some of them 20s, you know, 30s. Guys, we'd strip down to our underwear and we'd go through the posing routines. The women would be in there. Either in their underwear or they'd be wearing bikinis, usually in bikinis, I think, probably, and do their posing routines. And that was week in, week out, you know, with guys coming around correcting you, and you'd have to hold these poses for ages. And yeah, it's very strenuous. It's very particular.
Yeah, wow. Mariah, do you have an ideal body image that you would aspire to in the bodybuilding world?
Yeah, so I kind of came into the whole thing for a myriad of reasons, but one of the things that really piqued my interest is I used to go to antique fairs, and I started collecting bodybuilding magazines. So I saw like the old strongman magazines with Eugene Sandow, who's like the very first bodybuilder, and all the old school ones, and they were really expensive, so I kind of actually started collecting the slightly later ones, the silver era ones, because they're a little bit cheaper, more recent. And
what's the silver era?
That's like Steve Reeves, who used to be Hercules. Okay. So I'd actually say that, to me, guy-wise, is the ideal bodybuilder shape. I think it's the most aesthetically pleasing, and a body that's achievable naturally, and one where in clothes, you know, as Hercules or as a movie star, people wouldn't have seen him and immediately thought that's a bodybuilder. And so I think that's very sustainable. I think he looks amazing. His proportions were the whole emphasis was really on nice proportions. So legs that aren't too big, arms that aren't too big, everything that's in a golden ratio. And so, yeah, male-wise, I think that, to me, would be the perfect proportions. And women, like in terms of women, I used to also look at the women in the magazines. So they were strong women who would perform kind of feats of strength or circus-like things on Muscle Beach in the States back in, like,
There's
Venice Beach and Muscle Beach, like the ones where you'd see Arnold working out. Yeah, that. But before that, you had women that would do these incredible feats of strength, and they had really beautiful bodies. And then later on, now that we now kind of have categories like bikini, which is actually what I compete in, which appeals more to regular people, it's more to the masses because it's less muscly. That's a shape that is quite sustainable, and I think appeals to a lot of people in general compared to the bigger bodybuilding shape. And so I used to look at the early bikini bodybuilder competitors who are actually a lot less muscular than they are just a decade later. And they, to me, symbolized like the perfect shape, because it had a very strong emphasis on an hourglass shape. So building up like your glutes, your butt, and the shoulders. And in doing so, it makes your waist look smaller. You can actually look like more of an hourglass, and it's moving away from the 90s, which I grew up in, which was very get as skinny as you can, which I never was able to do in terms of my natural genetics and shape.
Yeah. So, Mariah, there you are at the antique fair collecting all these magazines, looking at the shapes. What actually made you go, I'm actually going to do this. I'm going to really dedicate myself to this.
So I just collected those because I liked antiques and I collect all kinds of things. But I'd been training for a few years and I'm naturally incredibly introverted and shy. And I remember thinking to myself, I want to do something that really pushed me out of my comfort zone. I want to do the scariest thing in the world. And I thought to myself, what could be more terrifying than standing in front of a crowd, an audience, on stage, like center of attention, basically in your underwear and in a bikini, being judged solely on how you look? And I just thought, that's just terrible. It's like a nightmare. And I thought, well, if I do this just once, I'll never be scared of anything ever again. And it didn't quite work out that way. Like, I still get scared, but I didn't actually know that your teeth and lips can shake. So I was there clattering, shaking. But I got through it. And when I did, I immediately thought, oh, just one more time. I'm just going to do a little bit better.
you got hooked. Well, of course, I mean, famously in the past couple of years, we had Barnaby Joyce's former wife, Natalie Joyce, decide that as her post-marriage hobby, I guess, she was going to take up bodybuilding as a way of stage.
It was amazing.
Did you?
Yeah, I didn't know who she was. I saw her competing. I was in Newcastle, I think it was, to watch this show. And then on the Monday, I think it was the next day in one of the newspapers, there was the picture of her, and I was like, oh my God, that's who I was watching. Yeah, it was amazing. She looked fantastic.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, so she also, I think, the same thing as you, Mariah, was a way of boosting her confidence. Now, Nigel, yeah. tell us your story. I mean, you did use the word vanity earlier, and you alluded to the fact that you were older than a lot of people were when they started bodybuilding. What got you there?
Yeah, and with the vanity thing, I think, you know, for me, I think it's good to acknowledge it. You know, for years, I was going to the gym, doing all sorts of things, you know, cardio, weight training, that sort of thing. And I would say to people, oh, you know, it's all about health and stuff. But really, you know, I just wanted to look good, you know. And I think it's fine to acknowledge that. You know, I've come to a point where it's fine to acknowledge that. And then one evening, I had seriously just thought, that world is not for me. It's not anything I could ever do. Never been involved in sport, didn't like sport, wasn't any good at sport at school. I was a good runner, but that's all. And then one evening I was with some friends and they were talking about things they'd love to do, bucket list type things. And I was thinking, oh, I don't really have a bucket list. And then I thought, oh, it just literally, I don't know where it came from. I thought, I didn't tell anyone at the time. I thought, oh, what about bodybuilding? And it was like, I think it's because people were talking about what they would love to do. And somewhere out of the back of my mind had it popped into the forward of my mind, the front of my mind. What about bodybuilding? What about competing? And it was like, from then on, it was on. It was so weird. It was like, I hadn't ever considered doing it before, but from that evening on, I took a few days to think about it. And then I realized there was masters competitions, grandmasters competitions, which is...
So age didn't need to be a barrier.
That's right. Yes. I really had thought, oh, I'm too old. And then someone said, well, there's always masters. And then I realised actually I'd be in grandmasters. But I thought, well, why not? And I was then everything slotted into place. Got the trainer. Got the
Did you get the same buzz that Mariah did when she got up there and went, oh, whoa, you know, this is great.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I too was incredibly self conscious. Can still be very self conscious. I, you know, never would wear a singlet out in the street ever. I'll wear a singlet in the gym now. You know, that's as far as I'll go. So suddenly I was there, you know, and for male bodybuilding, you have to wear not just underwear, but tiny underwear, shiny, tiny underwear. You have to get spray tanned, either completely naked or you put a sock over your private parts. First time I did it, I put a sock over my private parts. Second time I was like, oh, I don't care. These women have seen it all. They don't care. It was amazing. It totally opened my mind to a different world, and I saw it in a different way than I'd ever seen it before.
Yeah, so a common thread with the two of you seems to be that you both felt like you were shy, you were introverted, you were self-conscious, and this was a way of saying to yourselves, hey, I can do this. From the people you've met, does it attract many other people who I guess are in it for similar reasons to boost their self-esteem?
You go.
I wouldn't say that drastically changed anything for me. So when I was still terrified every other time, the only difference was as someone who likes to grow and improve, I just wanted to do it better because my feedback was that the posing wasn't great. And I thought, well, if I come back and I just improve on the posing, if I come back and I just improve on my back. So that was what it was about for me. But in terms of a confidence booster or doing something out of the comfort zone, I think I see more girls, particularly in the bikini category, that just want to have, a lot of them want to win. I was never really in it for the win. I was in it for the progress later on to see the difference and see how far I could grow as a person. But a lot of people would do it for the win. It's also now you have different federations. You have things like WBFF, which is more of a fashion one. So it kind of looks more of like a Victoria's Secret for meets fitness model look, which I think is also very alluring to a lot of women. Would love to parade down a stage looking the absolute best.
Now, I do want to talk to you about this idea of natural bodybuilding. And I think this is something you've both said, well, this is what I'm doing. I'm not doing the steroids. That's not – do people – do trainers come up to you and suggest steroids to you when you're in the gym? Did you have that experience?
I had a trainer who was probably quite old school in his methods. And he was a great guy. Really loved him. Fantastic guy. And he was also older. He was actually older than me. And he did say to me quietly, oh, you know, you maybe at your genetic potential, which is the age when you're not going to keep building muscle, you know, you might want to consider some help. And I was like, no, sorry. And it was like, I said, look, no judgment, absolutely no judgment, but it's not for me. I actually think that probably these days it's probably not such a thing in gyms that you get trainers sidling up to you, because I really think it happens in other ways. I think, Instagram, I get on my Instagram, I get messages from people, I get people following me and they're selling steroids. It's very, very public these days. So, I mean, it probably does go on in gyms, but I think there's other ways people can do it, buy them through the internet very, very easily. I don't know what the quality is that they would be buying, but it's not difficult.
Yeah, Mariah, did you see a lot of people who were following the steroid path to try and build muscle?
I think, once again, it depends on the category. So I know lots of bodybuilders who would use substances. In terms of like the bikini category, I think a lot of women who would use things would use more things like diuretics or things for fat burners, those kinds of things. In the higher levels, they probably would use some enhancements, but I mean, I always kind of just try and I like to give them the benefit of doubt and assume that people aren't using things.
Yeah, me
I
too,
think
actually, yeah.
There's
yeah.
more of pressure in the bikini category, and I've had suggestions a couple of times to get breast enhancements, because when you get really lean and you lose body fat, you also lose the fat around your breasts, yeah.
We are talking bodybuilding on Nightlife tonight. Nigel Bartlett is with us, author and journalist, an amateur bodybuilder. Mariah Stock, also a bodybuilder, and Dr. Maya Underwood, who's an anthropologist at the University of Queensland. Maya, I'll bring you back into the discussion. How common do you think steroid use is in bodybuilding, and why do you think there are some people in bodybuilding who decide that that's the route that they want to take?
Well, how common is it? Well, it is, it really depends on your competition. Obviously, bodybuilding as a whole, steroid use is the norm. And competitions where steroids aren't used are marked as other by the inclusion of the word natural in the competition name or the federation name. So it's an expectation at the top levels of bodybuilding that you're using steroids. You have to, because you cannot get to that level naturally. So it, I don't think people realize how prolific it is and how normal it is in bodybuilding. You have to do it to compete at the higher levels. You have no choice.
Now, is it considered completely legal? What's the status of it?
It's different from country to country. So in the UK, you can use steroids, but you can't manufacture or sell them. In the US, they are illegal. In Australia, they are illegal. In Queensland, where I live, they're a Schedule 1 drug equivalent to heroin, which is astounding given that the evidence doesn't suggest a huge amount of individual or social risk as a result of this drug, especially as compared to a drug like heroin or alcohol, for example.
I'm astounded that you're saying that basically everybody's doing it and the federations are basically acknowledging that everybody's doing it. Isn't that amazing? Well, it's amazing to me.
I'm very interested in that. Sorry, I didn't mean to talk over you.
Go ahead.
I mean, I would agree that does seem to be the case. And I don't know if surprise is the right word, but it's like, oh, it's interesting to me that it is a very normal thing. I've had, you know, some a sort of trainer in a well-known chain of gyms who I was chatting to mentioned to me that, oh, yeah, well, I compete and I'm amazed that you do it without assistance, because I do it with assistance and I find that hard enough. And I was like, oh, wow, this just guy's just telling me, you know, I've never barely met him before, telling me that he takes some form of steroids. And it's so widespread these days. It is legal, but it's not prosecuted generally.
Right.
So that's what I find interesting, and that's why I have no judgment on it really, because I don't think these people are not cheating because they're competing against each other. So they're not cheating. They would be cheating if they competed against me in a natural competition, but they're not cheating in their own competition. So it's just a choice. To me, it's just a choice they're making.
Okay, so Nigel, if they were cheating when they came to the natural competition, are you guys drug tested to see if it's all a level playing field or not?
Well, there's different natural federations, and the federation that I competed in, if each division has an overall winner, and then that overall winner would get tested. And I remember being backstage and someone had just won overall, which is it's the big thing, you know, and the head judge came through and said, oh, we need to grab you to do your test. So I certainly saw it happening. I don't know. I can't speak for the other federations, but I presume there's a level of testing.
The testing in ones you've competed in, Mariah?
So, I mean, I've heard that in terms of the testing, you know, that's how they test it and may be able to detect things from quite a while ago or not. So there's kind of questions as to how effective that is too. I personally competed in INBA, which is I Compete Naturally, and then I competed in ANB, which is also a well-known natural federation. And then I ended up competing in IFBB, which is one where I guess people in general say, okay, that's untested, but they were for quite a while pushing to be in the Olympics, in which case you would need to be tested. And I'm a natural athlete and I've competed in all three, and I probably would have stayed in INBA if I'd suited that look, but I found that I liked the way the athletes looked in the other federation, and I liked the way that was run at the time and everything, and that was the federation that has the Olympia, which is the biggest competition in the world. It's the one that Arnie competed in, and it's the most prestigious one, and that's the one that I wanted to be in.
So Maya, I'm really just really quite shocked here, I guess, to find out that, I mean, it's kind of like the Lance Armstrong defence, isn't it? Well, if I hadn't been taking drugs, I couldn't have won because everybody else was doing it as well. I mean, why do people who are competing in the top levels justify this?
Oh, well, look, there's it's just not possible to build those levels. Like if you're looking, say, at Olympia, which, as Mariah said, is you know, the ultimate in terms of bodybuilding, there is just no way that you can get to this sort of 300 pounds weight at 4 or 5% body fat. You can't do that naturally. It's just not possible. So it's just a necessity of the sport. But, you know, obviously at different levels, there are levels where is smaller muscularity is sought after, especially in women's competition, but increasingly so in men's. There are more divisions, you know, men's physique and classic era, which may not need steroids, but the bodybuilding at a higher level just have to do it. It's just not physically possible.
And where do they come from? Do they get prescribed by their doctors, or, you know, what's the system?
Not typically, because you can, I mean, steroids, we have to remember, are synthetic testosterone. So you can get a level of testosterone prescribed by the doctor, but it would be a TRT dose, a testosterone replacement therapy dose, which should, you know, be 150, 200 milligrams a week. That's not a bodybuilding dose. So you would, even if you were getting prescribed by the doctor, you would have to supplement that with more steroids. I think, as Nigel was saying, most purchases, I think, these days are done online. It's not, you know, hiding behind the gym, passing drugs to each other. And as Nigel also said, I'm on social media for my bodybuilding research. I'm not even a bodybuilder, and I get messages all the time, emails, Instagram messages saying, do you want to buy steroids? We've got great steroids, often from China. So it's pretty easy. I've had many bodybuilders say, you know, I can put a message out and have steroids delivered to me the next day.
Now, Maya, correct me if I'm wrong, but aren't there physical downsides and problems that are associated with steroid use?
Oh, yeah, look, don't get me wrong. There are physical risks, but compared to other drugs, they are quite low. They're sort of down at the level of LSD or magic mushrooms or marijuana. They're not huge risks, but so saying, the jury is sort of out on the long-term risk of steroid use. Most of the harms that are experienced are relatively minor, cosmetic ones, sort of like gynecomastia, the development of female breast tissue, typically female breast tissue, because the testosterone can convert to estrogen, acne, hair loss. You can get erectile dysfunction if you get hormone levels wrong, but the long-term risks are mainly around organ damage, and in particular concern is the heart problems, because if you think about it, it's probably pretty obvious, the heart is a muscle. So if you're increasing the size of your muscles, you can't sort of selectively do so. So some bodybuilders will get an enlarged heart, and that will cause problems and death. I think even Arnie's had heart attacks. He was at some stages relatively open about his steroid use and talked about, you know, Diana Bowl as the breakfast of champions.
Wow. Okay. I'm really quite, as I said, I'm quite astounded. But you two have never been tempted?
It has crossed my mind. Yes, it's crossed my mind. I even, you know, yeah, yes, it's a sport, and it's an extreme sport, and there's a, you know, you kind of get to a point and you think, oh, well, if I took that, then I could look like him. It's a lot of comparison going on, but I'm fortunate in that I think because I'm older and that sort of thing, I think I've got some wisdom about me that I know that for me personally, and it is just a personal choice, it's not a judgment, but I know that for me, it's not the right decision. I know that for me, if I was to even go down that route, I'd just want more and more and more. And I know that there's safer ways of doing it that aren't so risky. But I know that type of personality I am, I'd want to do more and more and more, and just, you know, quickly get into hot water.
So. We are running out of time. Mariah, why don't I ask you to wrap us up? What have you learned from bodybuilding about yourself, and what's it given you?
I think overall bodybuilding has made me feel strong. So it's taught me the benefits of building a strong physique. I started off as very looks orientated and really discovered the strength within it, the discipline, understanding what's actually in the food that you eat, what it's like to actually be dedicated to something long term and see the benefits of persisting. And yeah, overall, it's been incredible for me. And yeah, it's given me confidence and all kinds of things. It's been great.
Yeah. And Nigel, are you still bodybuilding?
I am in a very long off season. I may compete next year. I haven't fully decided yet. I'm still training and I'm still keeping in within the weight range where I could.
So does that mean you're having scrambled eggs at the moment?
Oh, I'm monitoring what I eat, but I eat whatever I want. Yeah.
Oh, that's how you know whether Nigel's serious. Thank you all. It's been such an insight for me learning about something I have no idea about. So thank you for coming and teaching me and all our listeners about the world of bodybuilding tonight. Mariah Stock, thank you. Nigel Bartlett, thank you. And also thanks to Dr. Maya Underwood, who is an anthropologist at the University of Queensland. Thank you, Maya.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.